From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today I'll speak with William Gibson, who just over 25 years ago published his first novel, Neuromancer, where he coined the term cyberspace. We'll talk about his latest, as well as where we are in this post-internet age.
Hello, I'm Jason Ponton, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, MIT's magazine that focuses on the future of technology. We're proud to underwrite Tech Nation. Our daily website features cutting-edge tech news, insightful blogs, and original videos every day at technologyreview.com.
William Gibson's latest book, Spook Country, has several parallel threads. It begins with would-be investigative reporter Hollis Henrian on the trail of an amazing new techno art.
You know, the art that Hollis has supposedly been assigned to cover, as far as I know, doesn't actually exist. But as far as I know, there's no reason we couldn't do it right now with stuff that you could buy at Future Shop and order off eBay. And I wanted to look at locative art because I think it says something about where we are now in relationship to the internet. But the real locative art that came up when I Googled it repeatedly was very academic and conceptual for the most part. So I gave up on that and invented a form of digital graffiti that was geographically bound and could only be viewed by looking through really retro 1980s VR goggles.
We know so many more people now have gotten the iPhone. Lots of people ran around with GPS units. Lots of people ran around with cell phones. But now with the iPhone, you say, where's the local pizza joint? Because, well, there's one here, you're here. Yeah. And it's obviously embedded. It obviously knows where you are. In fact, the cell phones pretty much knew where you were anyway. And we're beginning to understand so much more about, well, after Katrina. All the Katrina victims with access to the internet went to Google Earth and said, what does it look like here?
Yeah.
So now we're talking about creating some cyber art that perhaps you can only envision if you actually get to that GPS point.
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea in the book, that you actually have to go to, you have to go to the specific corner or the specific apartment to see the specific piece. But you can only see the specific piece if you're hardware enabled.
You got the goggles on.
Yeah.
And so what was the first thing in the book? I thought that was pretty fascinating.
The first piece you see in a book is a reconstruction of River Phoenix's death site.
Outside the Viper Room.
Outside the Viper Room. And I think I put that in because I've walked through it so many times, and I often think, oh, poor River, as I wander across the bubblegum there. Like, what a terrible place to die. But the first locative art that got me really excited was a project in central London, I think in Bloomsbury, where you would turn up at an office and they'd give you a little GPS-enabled gadget that you'd take out into the street. And it's sort of like those guided museum tours. It was an audio device. And as you wandered through Bloomsbury, you would encounter pieces that had
been... Oh, here.
Yeah, that had been scripted by different artists. So one would be some crazy kind of game that you could play with what was carved on the facade of a building. And another would be someone's heartfelt confessional about breaking up with a woman 30 years before in a very particular doorway. But you wouldn't trigger this artwork until you were within a few yards of the actual site. And I thought that was really interesting. And I immediately thought, well, this would be, and, you know, this would be amazing and also somehow very logical if it were visible, if these pieces were visible. And I didn't get into this in the book, but I've come to suspect that our grandchildren will be wandering around in a world where all of that stuff is available all the time. So you can sort of go to the National Geographic version of San Francisco and have everything you're seeing explained to you in footnotes in your natural field of vision, or not.
Well, dial the year. Yeah. I'm at this one spot, but what was it in 1936? Yeah. And what was it in 1910?
Yeah, that would be.
And every time you look, it's something different.
Yeah.
It's inhabiting the space in an information sense, but it's not there. But it is there.
Well, it's not there. The other thing I think about our grandchildren is I think that what they will find quaintest and most old-timey about us is the distinction we insisted on making between the so-called real and the virtual.
They'll think it's quaint, will they?
Yeah, I think they'll think it's quaint. Between the there and the not there, I think we're making a very... It's like an immigrant's mistake. The natives of the digital won't have that distinction.
Now, Hollis is a freelance reporter, and she's coming on board a to-be-developed magazine, which is, I think you described it as a European version of Wired, which is interesting because Wired actually is the reincarnation of a European magazine in reality. So there's kind of a throwback there.
Yeah.
I think Louis Rossetto and Jane Medcalf will be interested to see that. It turned out it went the other direction. So here's this reporter. She's been sent to Hollywood. She's not quite sure where the magazine is because is it someplace or no place? It hasn't really published anything yet.
Well, it's also her first gig. She wants to become a journalist, but she doesn't really have much in the way of journalistic credentials, having been a cult rock star before and then comfortably retired and then lost all her money, as sometimes happens to people.
Gotta go to
days.
Work.
Yeah, she has to go to work, and she always liked the idea of writing for a living, which I thought was kind of funny. But
is this the joke within the joke?
The magazine, yeah. And the magazine, it's never clear from the text whether or not it's going to exist. Most of the excuse for claiming that it's going to exist and pretending to be there turns out to be simply luring Hollis into someone's scheme where her real value is her ex-celebrity status.
That's right, because who doesn't want to meet this gal from the cult that actually, the cult band that actually has become even more famous since it disbanded?
Yeah, and that happens as well, you know. There are all these bands that become permanently iconic at a certain level who nobody was aware of when they were actually having their real-time career. And I like that because it points to how we're not only have we become post-geographical, but we're also atemporal, that we exist, our popular culture exists in some way outside of time. Even though it changes every day, once you're established as part of it, you're there. It seems that, you know, these days it seems like you'll be there forever.
Of course, there are many other people populating this novel. There's the Cuban, Asian, Russian immigrant young fellows, and there are some other people that seem to be sort of a CIA-like or clandestine operation going on. When all kinds of funny things are happening, as they happen in your novel, you have to be ready to sit down and read sort of this whole big broad brush, and then they start to come together and intertwine. Of this milieu, if you will, of the many people coming together, and we don't want to give anything away, of them, how many of these people do you think really exist? I mean, in any real sense?
Well, you know, I doubt that there's a direct equivalent to my Russian-speaking Cuban-Chinese illegal immigrant group who comprise in the book the smallest and most boutique-like crime family in the United States. There seem to be only about 20 20 of them in,
but they sure are fun
in the world at large. Yeah, they're a lot of fun, and they're also a faith-based operation. It's just not the faith we're used to. They all turn out to be very religious in their own way.
You say they'll be around forever, and I'm reminded of, I want to say it was the early 90s, you did a poem about your childhood,
yeah,
in which you put it on a computer disc that self-destructed after you played it once.
Well, the artist and curator I was working with attempted to do that, or perhaps only said that they were doing it. That is really the equivalent to doing it, but I was never entirely convinced that the self-erasing floppy disk, if you can imagine, actually self-erased. But the idea of it before we released the thing was very effective because it offended a lot of people, because my partners were asking huge amounts of money for each of these
self-erasing discs.
Each of these self-erasing discs. And the thing that annoyed people, and we had realized that this would happen, was that until you played it, thereby erasing it, you couldn't be sure that the disc wasn't blank.
Yeah, you just didn't do it right. Here's another disc for another enormous amount of money. I did find it interesting, though, the idea of, could you do something for one time only, and it just wouldn't exist forever. There is no internet archive. That's just a concept that I can't really imagine.
You just have to go out in the desert and do it when there's nobody around. Otherwise, once you leave traces on the internet, they'll be there in one way or another, as long as the internet is there.
William, you got so lucky that first time out with cyberspace. Have there been any other words that you thought you might get lucky with?
No, although recently, to my surprise, the term steampunk turns up over and over on the internet as a sort of, kind of pop aesthetic cult thing. And steampunk wasn't my word, but when my writing partner on our novel, The Difference Engine, Bruce Sterling, was asked what we were doing while we were writing that, he would semi-jokingly say, "Oh, we're writing a steampunk novel. It's about Victorians inventing totally functional steam-driven computers and history changing radically thereby." So there's been that. The lucky thing with cyberspace, really, was that I coined it without having any idea what it might mean. So I deliberately created an empty buzzword, which I knew would attract attention within my narrative, and people reading the novel would want to know what that was. So in the course of that first novel, I filled it in somewhat. So, the reader was satisfied to a certain extent. And then I kept using it. But while I was using it...
Along came cyberspace.
Yeah. While I was using it, the world, which had already been working on its own cyberspace, but not calling it that, grabbed my neologism and started filling it with its own meaning. So after that, as long as I continued to use it, I was constantly having to adjust my version of it with the world's version of it. And after three books, I quit using it. And I've never used it in a work of fiction since that third novel, with the exception of Spook Country, where one of the characters stops and talks at, some small length about where cyberspace is today. And I was a bit nervous about doing that at first because it seemed I was sort of breaking the third wall of the painting. But I'm glad I did, because I think she makes a valid point, and it's sort of it's like a bullet point in a lecture. It sort of serves to get that little, my one little techno lecture out there in front of the audience. And, you know, it goes by in about a page.
Why did you feel you needed to say something at this point?
Well, I think that when I wrote Neuromancer, there already was an internet. I wasn't doing it. And you really had to, the learning curve was very steep, but people were exchanging email. And the net was, some people were exchanging email, and the net was starting to grow. And in sort of through the 80s, when we said cyberspace, culturally, we meant cyberspace was there. We're here, and cyberspace is there. It's this other digital realm. And I think the way it's changed is that cyberspace is now here. Cyberspace is where we are, and there has become the lack of connectivity. There is where your iPhone can't get a signal. There is where there's no Wi-Fi. There is where there's no email. And so I think that it's turned itself inside out and swallowed the world, literally. But we haven't noticed yet. And I think that ultimately will be the thing that most dates Neuromancer, so that in the later 21st century, people will be reading it in order to get their heads around a day when the digital was thought of as being some small part of the world.
You can tell me now, evert, to say something turns itself inside out, and you said now, I think you become part of it. It becomes part of you. Am I on the right track there?
Yes, although I didn't actually coin evert. The everted lips, for instance, or lips that are very much turned outwards, and various parts of the human anatomy can evert under
cyberspace content.
Certain circumstances. So it's a quasi-medical term, but I liked it because I persist in thinking that there's something organic about the overall structure of the internet, which is, after all, largely an unplanned artifact or system. It was never, it was never planned from the top down. It's just evolved.
Well, actually, it's true of any technology. The original creators or builders of any technology can never predict how it will be used.
No.
And the internet is totally ripe for that kind of innovation by anybody who uses it.
Absolutely. And to the extent that anyone tries to control it from the top down, they stop it growing, and they stop it evolving optimally.
And it'll always have underground innovation.
That's
the way it is, the way we humans are. I was also struck as I was trying to wrap my head around the idea that we had become and are becoming right now sort of one with this cyberspace, if you will, in that, if you think about when telephones first came on the scene, it's like I talked to you over the telephone versus I didn't, and were they we real, and what were this, was this really communication? We all know that talking with any of our friends over the telephone, it's as real as not. Everything that can happen will happen in both spaces. Different things can happen in both spaces.
Yeah.
But it's real, and it's a part of our lives, our richness. And the same is true of how the internet, especially in these iPhones and cell phones and anything that gets us instantly to each other and to our outside world, how that is very real for us, and we can't imagine going back now.
Yeah. And also, I think it changes us. Emergent technologies change us in ways that we subsequently can't get a handle on. And people, over the past 25 years, when people have asked me what I thought the internet had done to us, what it was doing to us, I would tell them I had no idea, because I still have no idea what broadcast television did to us. It obviously did a lot, but I can't get a handle on it because I am too much of it. I can dimly remember a day before I had encountered broadcast television, but I have no idea what it was like. I can dimly remember my father bringing our first television home, but I was very small, and the rest of my life was the life of a broadcast television animal. And it's like in, you know, the first lesson in anthropology 101 is that you can't know your own culture. So I think we have that problem. We change with it and then are unable to really to imagine. It's a greater feat of imagination to try to imagine the previous state.
Writer William Gibson was asked to convert his short story, Johnny Mnemonic, to a screenplay, which would eventually star Keanu Reeves. I asked him if it was difficult bringing the technology aspects of the story to life.
When Johnny Mnemonic was made, the technology didn't actually exist to represent what we were describing, which is extraordinary when you think about it. But we wound up with two really talented and really daring graphic artists in Boston, down in a basement somewhere, with one big old hard drive, or what in those days was a big old hard drive, and it was running all the time, and we lived in perpetual fear of there being a power blackout in that part of Boston, because if the disc had stopped spinning, they would have lost it all. I mean, it's just like, I mean, you think about it now, it wasn't a
very big disc. You couldn't go over to Best Buy and get or CompUSA and get a little bitty thing to back it up four times.
Apparently not. Or if we could, these guys didn't know, and they were the guys who were getting the job done. And, you know, the world just isn't like that today.
Did it look the way you envisioned it, or did you have to keep making compromises?
Well, you know, for the purposes of the screenplay, I don't think I really bothered to describe it. And the art director probably went with the descriptions in Neuromancer. And in the text of Neuromancer, there's a suggestion that it looks something like a city. And I always thought that the Neuromancer, rather the Johnny Mnemonic cyberspace, looked too much like a city, and that it was that would be confusing to the audience, the people who weren't familiar with the concept from the novel. They'd think, well, he's entered some kind of like glittery science fiction city now. I thought it should have been more abstract.
To me, of all your novels, this one is the most ready to go to movie. I mean, the very idea you could be sitting there fixed on the spot in Hollywood where poor River Phoenix went down, and people are walking through it and driving by, and yet you could almost have a hologram of what was going on there. And you've got the exit of the drive at the Chateau Marmont. You've got all of these places. It really lends itself to this. And yet, would you be up for writing another screenplay, working with more Hollywood producers and actors?
I don't know. I think I've had my run as a screenwriter. I was very fortunate in that my day job writing novels has always amply paid the rent and paid for the groceries. So I never looked at screenwriting as a you know, step up in wage. And in fact, my accountants used to get very angry with me when I'd accept screenwriting jobs, because they'd go on forever and I'd usually wind up making less than I could have made writing a novel in the equivalent period of time. But I've never been entirely sure that I was very good at it. I have much more faith in my abilities as a novelist. And I think I've gotten to the point where I would just like prefer to have someone else do it, and then I will have bear no aesthetic responsibility.
There you go.
For the outcome, because you just can't control the thing that people who haven't really, you know, in our society, everyone believes they know really a lot about how films are made. I don't know where that comes from, but most people have never actually had the incredibly scary experience of getting into an argument with someone who represents some sort of corporate entity that has just invested $130 million spent $130 million shooting a film, and you're disagreeing with that entity about how the final product should be. You really don't have too much of a chance.
You have to be there to get that one.
Yeah, you really have to be there to get that. Because, I mean, people will kill you for a few thousand dollars. The stuff you don't even want to know the stuff they'll do to you for $130 million.
And you kind of paced your speaking. You know, that's the way you've always been. I can imagine these types are talking really fast, and you're driving them crazy just speaking slowly.
Yeah, sometimes, although they have their own slow speakers. I mean, they usually have a whole army of guys that you have to, and gals that you have to deal with.
It seems to me that when you were first writing novels, you were writing in sort of the far future. And as were your more recent ones, they're more present, or just about, as you said, there's no reason why this can't happen now. Is that where you're going to stay?
Well, I think when I started writing, I really started writing fiction around 1980 was when I really began trying to write fiction. And in 1980, I had a pretty good yardstick for the general level of weirdness abroad in the world in 1980. And in order to do what I do with science fiction, I would then come up with a construct that was a little bit longer on either end than my weirdness yardstick. And what I was able to do was really dependent on the accuracy of the weirdness yardstick to give readers in those days a certain kind of buzz. But by the time I got to the end of my second 3-volume set of more future novels, I started to feel like I was really working, you know, we're in the 90s and I'm working with an 80s yardstick. And part of my strategy with these last two books has been to work with the real 21st century, 25 years later. And it's considerably weirder than my old 80s yardstick right there. But I think what I may be doing at another level is trying to calibrate an early 21st century yardstick to figure out how much weirder I would need to make it to do the future thing again. Although, on the other hand, as one of the characters in Pattern Recognition, my previous novel, says, our present has become so small and so incredibly brief that we no longer have the space in the present on which to build these bridges of extrapolation into the future. Well, the present used to be, imagine when I was a little kid, the present was about 3 years long, and the present is now the length of a news cycle.
And that's gotten shorter and
shorter. Yeah, and that's getting shorter and shorter all the time.
If there's anything I took away from your novel, is a sense that every place we are in the world is actually many things. In your particular novel, Spook Country, they're replicating events that happened on that spot in a prior time. And there could be a novel of that. In fact, there could be fictional events that were created from in that. All of these things are possible. I think instead of there being a less of a sense of place because it was sort of out in cyberspace, that other that you've been talking about, it's like everywhere has many possibilities now because of all this technology that it didn't really have before. It has a history, in a sense, potentially accessible always. Very interesting.
I agree with you, absolutely. It's the world's attic is being sorted. There are very few, you know, there are no more lost places. And, you know, give it a couple of hundred years, there'll be no more lost cities. They'll have found everything. The future, wielding currently inconceivable tools of forensic transparency, is going to figure out everything that any major player ever did. So, you know, boy, whatever you're doing today, if you're a big enough deal, the future is going to know your secrets because they're going to have information tools that you can't even begin to imagine. And that basic curiosity that humanity has always had about what really happened.
And I think one of the strangest experiences for me is I once did an interview, actually, with Sir Edmund Hillary at the top of one of the World Trade Centers, at the very top. The office is right at the top. And it was so real for me, and that interview was so real for me, and we still have that interview, and Sir Edmund is no longer with us. But that space no longer exists. It was a man-made space. And yet, it does exist, and it does exist right where it is.
Yeah.
If I had had a GPS reading that day, I could tell you right where it is in space, and yet you can't really get there anymore, and yet it's real.
Yeah, but we're capable of drifting in time now the same way we're capable of drifting geographically through the digital to that time and place.
Well, William, always wonderful. You're welcome anytime on Tech Nation. Come back. See us anytime.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
My guest today is William Gibson. His latest, Spook Country, is now out in paperback. More information about this interview is available at www.technation.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of Tech Nation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Tech Nation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.